Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
We begin today in Washington, where the Senate will render a verdict next hour on the impeachment trial of President Trump. He's almost certain to be acquitted in a mostly party-line vote, though former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, now a senator from Utah, just announced that he will vote guilty. The impeachment conclusion comes a day after the president delivered his third State of the Union address. Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan was in the House chamber for last night's speech, and she joins us now. Congresswoman Trahan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks, Callum.
You joined many female members in wearing white, the color of the women's suffrage movement. This has become a tradition at President Trump's State of the Union speeches. And then Trump went on to tout low unemployment for women, and he claimed to be, quote, building the world's most prosperous and inclusive society. So what did you make of his remarks, Congresswoman?
I wasn't surprised. I was incredibly disappointed, but I wasn't surprised by that. I mean, the president, he chose to effectively have a campaign rally in the People's House. And I think the part that was just more disheartening than usual is that we could have gone through his speech line by line and fact-checked it or counted it. I mean, it was essentially a collection of lies, whether he was talking about the reduction of number of people with SNAP benefits because his administration has kicked them off, to the lip service he, you know, paid to lowering prescription drug prices. I just completed my first year, and we managed to pass 275 bipartisan bills, all while we were, holding this administration accountable and leading an impeachment inquiry. So we don't have much use for words; they don't mean that much. Actions do, and this president has little to show for his 3 years in office.
Well, you mentioned the effort to lower drug prices, and that is, at least on its face, a bipartisan goal. Let me play a little bit of what the president said on that point, and then I want to ask you to elaborate.
I'm calling for bipartisan legislation that achieves the goal of dramatically lowering prescription drug prices. Get a bill on my desk, and I will sign it into law immediately. With unyielding commitment, we are curbing the opioid epidemic.
So just what you're hearing in the background there, if it's a little hard to make out, is chants of H.R. 3, which is the Lower Drug Costs Now Act. It passed in the Democratic-controlled House, but it's languishing in the Senate. Congresswoman, explain what the bill would do, and can you Democrats get President Trump on board, do you think?
You bet. So I was one of those people chanting H.R. 3, because when the president says, just put a bill on my desk and I'll sign it, well, we've done that. That bill was passed months ago. And what it basically does, it allows Medicare to negotiate directly with drug companies, which is something this president has previously supported. So, this is about, the president kind of working with the Congress on things that he has talked about, whether it's been through his campaign or in, the last two State of the Unions. Those are the two that I've been to. But, look, he lacks credibility on health care. He also stood up there and said he's going to ensure that every person with a pre-existing condition gets to keep their insurance coverage. I mean, Bill Barr is sitting in the room. He's fighting in the Texas courts to take that coverage away. So
to repeal Obamacare, you mean, which, of course, has that protection.
Yes,
in there.
Which would actually take that safeguard from people that have pre-existing conditions. And so, we've been... I was curious about what he was going to say about health care because it's such an important issue, not just to the country, it's absolutely the thing I hear most about when I'm home. But we will make sure that Mitch McConnell, understands that there's a bill on his desk. We're willing to talk seriously about negotiating on that deal. But it's, we've got 274 other pieces of legislation that he's just let pile up.
Well, related to health care and prescription drugs, let me ask you about the guest you brought to last night's State of the Union. You had Cheryl Jouer with you. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so Cheryl is, she's an incredible woman. She lost her son, Corey, to an opioid overdose when he was 23 back in 2011. And she has basically, like so many women that I have met in the last couple of years, dedicates her life to getting rid of stigma so that more people who are struggling with substance use disorder get the treatment that they need, and supports families, not just in Massachusetts or in her hometown of Marlborough, but across the country. She helps people in recovery with the support that they need. And so, you know, I was also interested in what the president was going to say about the opioid epidemic and, you know, the fact that the federal government needs to increase the resources that we're sending to states to combat.
He says he's curbing the opioid epidemic. Is that what you see, or do you disagree?
No, I think that if you talk to any family or any in a city like Lowell or Lawrence or Methuen or Haverhill, you know, no one feels as though we're beating this. You know, while Massachusetts has made, you know, some progress and some investments, you know, this does take the heft of the federal government. And we have a long way to go. You know, I have a bill right now that would make doctors get online training only 8 hours to get so that they can treat patients when someone is in there, in for their visit, right? Right now, we don't have doctors who can actually prescribe medication-assisted treatment because they don't have those tools and that training. So, you know, this is something I know is bipartisan. I go to a weekly breakfast with freshman members from both sides, Republican and Democrat, and this is something that, you know, the president has to step up and you know, help us, you know, get to a deal with you know, real resources behind it.
I wonder, though, Congresswoman, though, as you talk about trying to form a bipartisan consensus on an issue like drug prices, do some of the protests that we saw last night run counter to that notion? I mean, for example, we saw your colleague, Ayanna Pressley, boycott the speech. Representative Seth Moulton walked out. And, of course, in a very sort of theatrical moment, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, ripped up her copies of the president's speech. Is that productive?
You know, I was asked last night about Ayanna. Look, no one blames Ayanna for not going into the chamber to listen to this president's speech. He has repeatedly singled her out, and he's viciously attacked her on Twitter in disturbing ways. And she had every right to boycott that speech, as did other members. I mean, look, I'll be honest with you. There were more than a few moments when I wanted to leave because I couldn't stomach some of the you know, the inappropriateness that was happening in the chamber, like the awarding of the Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh. But I'll tell you, you know, I also had this moment where I was sitting amongst my colleagues, clad in suffragette white. You know, I did draw a degree of satisfaction knowing that when the president was talking about closing the gender pay gap or paid family leave and all the rest, that he knew in his heart that the driving force behind those achievements were the women in white before him and not himself. And I think that visibility means something to viewers. And look, I also think we have a model for Republicans and Democrats working together. We just passed the USMCA. And let me tell you, when we got that bill...
The Mexico-Canada trade agreement, just to fill in the acronym.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that was in the thick of impeachment, right? I mean, we was in you know, from September to December, that working group headed by Chairman Neal was really working to get that deal to be something that could actually pass the Congress, right? It was not good for workers or for the environment or for, you know, any of the important stakeholders until Democrats made those improvements. And we got the U.S. Chamber to sign off on it. We got the AFL-CIO to endorse it. So that is the model that we need to use, right? When the president talks about infrastructure, we know the path to getting a good infrastructure deal. We just did it with USMCA. So I think you can do both at the same time. I mean, look, a lot of this is, you know, us working on the ground floor, you know, us not negotiating maybe directly with the president, but with the administration and with Senate Republicans to get things done with the American people. And we have to keep on that.
So let me just ask you in the moment we have left. You do have the New Hampshire primary coming up on the heels of a really disorganized, to say the least, Iowa caucuses. And you've heard, surely, the criticism that perhaps Iowa and New Hampshire shouldn't be first in the nation anymore. Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, so look, our party and our country, you know, it's diverse, and I think our nominating process should reflect that. I completely endorse reevaluating how our nominations happen in a way that elevates all the voices that make up our party's coalition, and that to me is just common sense. You know, I think Monday's chaos does underscore the need to move away from caucuses. I mean, look, we had a transparent caucus, and I think it raised some serious concerns. I know I saw too many videos on Twitter of delegates being awarded by a coin toss. And we're better than that. Who I really feel bad for were the campaigns, the organizers, you know, all those volunteers who have been pouring their blood, sweat, and tears into Iowa for years or months. You know, as you know, I endorsed Senator Warren last year, and, you know, she had a strong showing in Iowa, and she's moving her focus to New Hampshire and beyond with considerable momentum and organizational strength. So I look forward to being in New Hampshire for her this weekend.
All right. Congresswoman Lori Trahan represents the 3rd Massachusetts Congressional District. Congresswoman, thanks again for your time.
Oh, thank you, Callum. Take care.
With me now in the studio is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who is fresh back from those Iowa caucuses. Anthony, welcome back to Boston.
Hey, Callum. Nice to be back.
Also with us from Concord, New Hampshire, is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Callum.
We've got some nice music in the background behind you, Chris. Where exactly on the trailer are we catching you?
So I am set up here at the Youth Climate and Clean Energy Town Hall. It's at the Bank of New Hampshire stage in downtown Concord. You mentioned you can hear some filler music behind me. It's been buzzing here all day. We've heard from 5 candidates and a surrogate so far. There's a couple more to come. We're in a little bit of a lull right now, but folks are pretty engaged in it here.
What's the mood? I mean, this started pretty early in the morning. Were folks jazzed to get to this thing?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised. I got here about 7:30, and the sidewalks were already packed with people who were standing out there with signs, campaigning for their candidate. There's even a pro-Trump campaign set up down there with a video display. The energy that was here at 7:30 in the morning was shocking to me, especially when you're talking about an all-day town hall event. We had talked earlier in the summer about whether or not New Hampshire still has that special magic, that first-in-the-nation primary feel to it. Folks here are clearly engaged and excited for this election.
Well, Anthony Brooks, jump in here on that, because we were just talking with Lori Trahan about whether Iowa and New Hampshire should still be first in the nation. And this sort of engagement that Chris is describing in the Granite State is one of the justifications that New Hampshire residents list as a reason they should keep their status. They say they've built this culture over decades of being really hyper-engaged, and here they are turning out at 7:30 on a Wednesday morning.
Absolutely. I mean, look, there are two ways to look at this, and clearly that argument is a valid argument. Of course, the people in New Hampshire and of Iowa are sincere about the way that they engage in these campaigns. But I think the lesson from Iowa, I think I agree with Lori Trahan, is there have been these discussions for a long, long time about whether these two states represent the diversity of the U.S., and clearly they don't. And I think what we saw in Iowa, this meltdown of the caucus process because of this new app, was just a reminder of that. And I think it's going to bring to the surface, again, to the forefront, this criticism of starting this process with these two states. And, Callum, I would just say this. You know, I'm struck by... I watched a caucus on caucus night in Des Moines, and it was a precinct in downtown Des Moines, about 900 people. And you really have to be in the room to watch this. And on the one hand, you can be impressed with a level of civic engagement that exists and neighbors coming together.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it's the most bizarre way to run an election. It really is bizarre.
I like the time-lapse videos on Twitter that really illustrate
it's like
it
herding cats. It's chaotic. There were new rules. There were new procedures. And then there was all this concern, of course, about the new app. But I don't even think the new app is the problem here, because to me, the sort of metaphor is it's like hooking an app up to a feed bag on a horse and buggy. You know, the horse and buggy is the problem here. This is not an efficient or particularly democratic way. In fact, I'd go this far. I would say if you wanted to design a system to exclude as many people as possible from voting, organize a Iowa-style caucus. I mean, very few people can get to these caucuses. They exclude working people, overnight janitors, cab drivers, people who can't afford child care. It's the most bizarre way to initiate what is, you know, the beginning of a really consequential set of decisions in the election season.
So we're talking politics with WBUR's Anthony Brooks here in the studio and Chris Siderick up in New Hampshire. And you can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is in Burlington, Mass. John, what's on your mind? Go ahead, John.
Yes, how you doing? My name is John. I'm work at MIT at Cambridge, and I feel as though I don't have a candidate to vote for. I hate Trump ethically and morally all around, but I don't feel as though fiscally I can vote for a Democrat because, you know, you can't take care of the whole world. You need border control, and you need to control spending, and I don't feel as though they like giving it away. And I work hard for mine. I pay for my three kids to go to college. I'm in debt up to my yin-yang.
Yeah, I bet.
And I just feel as though the Democrats are, you know, I know they say a lot, but financially I'm going to pay for everybody's education. That's what they want.
All right, John, thank you for the ring. Chris Siderick, can I go back to you? Because John says he's still trying to make up his mind. He doesn't like the idea of voting for the president's reelection, but he's having a hard time choosing a Democrat. So help him out. You were with a lot of the Democratic candidates today. What did they have to say that might help John make up his mind?
Well, first of all, we also heard from another Republican candidate, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who was here and really kind of preaching this idea of going beyond the party system and trying to find a common set of values. So that's one option for you, John. I also heard from Senator Amy Klobuchar, who talked a lot about kind of the missed opportunities with climate change, but more also about the framing in terms of how we present this issue to the American public. She talked about working on the state level on climate legislation and said that some of their best allies were people who were enthusiastic hunters or who loved fishing or snowmobiling, folks that wouldn't necessarily politically align with Democrats, but by the framing of the issue, it really kind of helped them connect to what was at stake.
This terrorism came from countries that we don't want to be dependent on for their foreign oil. So why don't we do akin to a carbon tax, put that money into developing our own renewable energy? I swear to God, 80% of the country at that moment would have said yes. It would have seen as patriotism. But instead, at that moment, he asked people to go shopping.
I think she's talking to George.
So that was
about
actually
George
her that
W. Bush
about.
There, right? So
yes,
Anthony Brooks, how about that argument then? I mean, you got Amy Klobuchar saying, you know, this climate issue is something that people across the aisle can maybe agree on, but we got to frame it the right way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, but I was struck by John's phone call and you know, struggling for a candidate to look for. And I have to say, one of the sort of overriding impressions that I had when I was out in Iowa, it wasn't so much that everyone reflected exactly what John was saying, but this struggle that people are engaged with, looking for the right candidate. And the sort of the tension that I was struck by out there was this tension between people wanting to vote their heart or else wanting to sort of look for that candidate who they thought other people would find more electable. And it was sort of tying them in knots. And so as a result, a lot of people were leaving their decision right up to the last minute. And I think the same tension is on the ground among Democrats in New Hampshire. There are, you know, there is this tension between who is the most electable person and who do people really want to vote for. I think in part that explains why Elizabeth Warren, for example, has lost some support. I think there are a lot of questions about, you know, I'm ready to vote for a woman, but is the rest of the country ready to vote for a woman? She's certainly facing those kinds of questions and has begun to address them directly in her campaign speeches. So, yeah, interesting time for Democratic voters.
So what are you hearing then from voters, Chris? You're on the ground in Concord right now. What are they telling you today?
Well, there's one thing that I've heard from a couple of folks that I thought was really interesting. I spoke to one of the students who asked a question of Pete Buttigieg, Jedediah Crook, and I asked him if he thought that climate change was an important issue to the voters of New Hampshire. Obviously, today's event is completely dedicated to climate change. But if you look at the surrounding states of the Northeast, New Hampshire hasn't always kept pace with climate legislation. Here's what he had to say about what voters are thinking about climate change here in the Granite State.
I think it's an important issue to voters in this state, but only in direct ways in which it either benefits or hurts them, as I'm sure it is to, like, most people across the country. But, from what I've seen, it, at least in terms of who we have voted for locally, it doesn't seem to be a major issue for a lot of the folks living in the state.
So folks who are here today, obviously very concerned about this issue. We'll see if that is reflected at the polls next Tuesday.
Yeah, let's hear from a few more, too. On the line with us is Karen in Lawrence. Karen, what are you thinking about?
Well, as we're talking about the various ways in which our democracy is broken, starting with how the caucuses were, like, so weird, and I really liked the idea that it was like herding cats. But the real big elephant in the room, so to speak, is, to me, is the Electoral College. And until we fix that, I don't think we're going to have fair elections because, you know, in the last election, the Electoral College gave Donald Trump the presidency when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. And it's set up in such a way that it really favors the Republicans. And so until we do something about the Electoral College, I don't think we're going to have fair elections again.
Okay.
For a long time.
Karen, thanks for the ring. Let's try to get one more. Bob is in Providence. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, Anthony was pointing out the shortcomings of the caucus system. I'd like to mention that the primary system is equally problematical. Most folks don't vote in either party, and instead the party primaries are vulnerable to a relatively small, activist, unrepresentative elite. On the Democratic side, it's the left and socialists. On the right-hand side, it's the hard right. On the Republican side, it's the hard right. In neither case do these folks represent the broad base of the party. And so, like the Democrats right now, we may be in a situation where they nominate an unelectable person who is a socialist. America is not a socialist country. It is a center-right country. And while, you know, I can vote for Bernie, I don't think the public will.
All right, Bob, thank you. Thanks for the ring, Bob. We got it. Anthony, so he was sort of responding to what you said, but I'm hearing a lot of process critiques here. You say the caucus is kind of a mess. Bob says primaries aren't much better.
No,
Karen says the Electoral College is messed up. We got a lot of complaints about the process.
No, there are a lot of complaints, and I think there's validity to all these complaints. I completely agree with Bob, by the way, and I didn't mean to pick exclusively on the caucus process. There's no question that the primary process rewards involvement of the extremes of the two parties. Absolutely. No problem. And I'm not sure what the solution is to that. I'm really not. I mean, I think one of the solutions to the New Hampshire, Iowa stranglehold is to think about, I don't know, a rotation of states every election cycle, or maybe a rotation of groupings of states that would go first. That might be a little more democratic.
You know, Chris, as we
talked
about,
I'd love to ask you, Anthony, if I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to that point, I think one of the things that's jumped out from today's event is, even though this is a 300-seat theater, the vibe that the candidates are giving off is a very informal one. It's almost as if everyone's sitting around the table kind of having a conversation naturally. And I'm wondering, Anthony, do you think that's reflective of campaign style in New Hampshire specifically? And would you potentially be losing that if it moved to a bigger state?
You would obviously lose the sort of intimate contact if you move to a grouping of, I mean, look, that's one of the arguments in favor of Iowa and New Hampshire. Is these are two states that are very good at sort of doing this and expecting this, and candidates have to kind of adapt their styles to it, and you do have that sort of intimate contact. That's a positive thing about the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, but I don't think it has to be exclusive to those two states. I mean, I'm sure if you had a caucus system or a primary system that began in, I don't know, Arkansas, that folks down there would respond very well as well. But yeah, I think that would be the danger. You would lose that kind of intimate contact, but you have to ask what kind of price we're paying now for this system.
All right, let's squeeze in one more call. Jeannie is in Wareham. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Hi, I just think it's really important for everybody to come together over the fact that what's the real issue that people care about is defeating Trump. Everybody's talk about kitchen table issues and things like that, and the Democratic Party needs to unite. And I really believe that if Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren were to share the ticket, then you'd probably get both sides of the coin. You'd get someone who's liberal, and you'd get someone who really knows the inside out of our government and who's been doing it for years. I think it's so important to really recognize that what the Democratic Party needs to do right now is to defeat Trump.
All right, Jeannie, thanks for the ring. Last word to you, Anthony Brooks. So Jeannie says the important thing is to defeat President Trump, but I'm hoping you can just kind of pull the lens back on the last week or so and the little bit of week to come, because I think you'd have to say politically the president's had a very good stretch. I mean, he had this mess in Iowa that he could laugh about on Monday. He had a State of the Union last night that was very theatrical. He's about to get acquitted probably later today. Jeannie wants to knock him out of office, but he might be in good shape.
Well, he certainly is having a good week. There's no question about that. And he's going to be hard to beat in November with an economy going that strong and a very fervently committed base. But I understand where Jeannie's coming from. And this is certainly what you hear from Democratic voters across Iowa and New Hampshire, that no matter what, they're committed to defeating Trump. And I think that's sort of the challenge, the kind of existential challenge that they're facing, is trying to figure out which candidate is best suited to defeat Trump. And there isn't really a clear answer to that. And that's why we have primaries.
Any clarity forming where you are, Chris, as the Democratic voters try to get behind somebody who's going to beat President Trump?
You know, the overriding theme of folks I've talked to today is just they're kind of frustrated with the bickering of our current political environment, and they really want to see folks coming together and trying to craft real-world solutions. That's been kind of the bottom line.
All right. That is Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick in Concord, New Hampshire for us. Chris, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Cal.
Also with us in studio was WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Thanks, Anthony.
Hey, my pleasure.
It is time once again for Paris in Boston. That's our colleague Paris Alston exploring the region and showing us what she's found. Hey there, Paris.
Hey, Callum. How's it going?
Well. So today I understand you're taking us to the heart of Nubian Square,
where
Haley House Bakery and Cafe is reopening after being closed for almost a year. Remind us what Haley House is all about and why did it close down temporarily?
Yeah, so Haley House is a social enterprise, which means they're a business, but they have this mission of doing good and uplifting the community where they operate. So it was a really big deal when they closed because the community felt like it was losing a staple of who they are. And when they closed, the owners said they were taking a temporary hiatus to reevaluate its business model, which meant finding a way to balance its identity as a nonprofit and social enterprise with the need to run a business that actually makes a sustainable profit.
Ah, so were they able to do that? I mean, what did they do in the year that they were closed?
So in that time, a number of things happened. The cafe and bakery obviously closed, but they were still able to continue their catering services as well as a number of social services that they're known for offering. They also renovated the space, so they kind of improved its old space and made it fresh and shiny and added a lot of new sparkling touches. And they hired a woman named Misha Thomas as general manager for the bakery. And she, along with a number of other management and members of the staff, went through training in what's called open book management. And that's where they learned how to run a business like theirs, especially from a financial standpoint. And when I sat down with Misha to talk more about that, she said that's an education that the cafe really needed.
Looking at past menus alone, I can see huge discrepancies on what they were charging, even for something like, you know, a cookie or coffee. The cost of goods were extremely out of whack. The labor levels were also extremely unbalanced for what the organization actually needed and what this cafe could sustain from a revenue point of view.
So in that sense, was the model ever working sustainably?
From my opinion, it doesn't look like it was. And I think on a lot of levels, it's something the organization is healing from in large part. You know, a nonprofit that runs a soup kitchen, they're very used to giving away food for free.
Mm.
And you can't run a cafe or a food industry business at all and give away food for free.
So how do you balance that with wanting to be this service in the community that is accessible for everyone, but you also got to make money?
Mm. Just getting everybody on the same page, from staff to you know, volunteers and folks that are over at the office too. It's like, hey, generating revenue means that we balance labor and cost of goods in this way. We communicate that to the customer and set expectations accordingly. The cafe itself, it's always kind of been sustained by some grant funding and some local folks, and then what it does on a business level, but the idea now is that we're able to, as much as we can, sustain ourselves and act as a positive model for other folks that are trying to run social enterprises as well. So we're still looking at training people from the neighborhood, training people and hiring people that have backgrounds of incarceration or have question marks on their quarry, training them up and giving them the skills so if they want to move forward in the restaurant industry, they can. If they want to move forward as an entrepreneur, they can, given what they learn here and our new management style. And that's kind of the training that we're implementing with our folks here now.
And just to note, Callum, that CORI stands for Criminal Offender Record Information, which, of course, is a record of an individual's criminal history.
And as she said, that was a big part of the Haley House mission, was to give people who maybe have a blemish on their background a second chance, who maybe wouldn't find a job elsewhere. So
that's
what
right.
did those people do when the cafe shut down for a year?
So unfortunately, Callum, many of them had to be laid off because the cafe wasn't up and running. But they were the first people that Haley House reached out to when they were reopening the cafe. And in that time, some of them had gone on and found other jobs.
Which maybe is good news.
Exactly, because maybe even better paying jobs. So that was a good thing. But some of and they didn't come back necessarily, but some of them did come back. And Misha says that they do hope to hire others back as things continue to get up and running.
So she mentioned that maybe the menu's changing, maybe some of the pricing had to change, there's some new staff. What else is changing at Haley House?
So as I mentioned earlier, the space changed. So they have this new, fresh space. And it was my first time at Haley House, actually. So I wasn't really familiar with what it looked like before and wasn't able to do the compare and contrast. But I did meet some people who were able to do that. And I spoke with a woman named Taishia Smith. She's actually an employee who was able to continue working at Haley House throughout its closing and renovation. And she's a fan of the new look.
It's more space, color-wise. I mean, it looks brighter because of, you know, the different color paint that they use. I mean, I like it. I still miss some of the art, you know, like the local art and stuff like that. Hopefully we'll bring that back. But I also like the black and white pictures. They're different.
So that local art that she's talking about was actually part of a program that Haley House did called Art is Life Itself. And that's where they would showcase local artists and they would put up these really colorful, vibrant pieces of art that really uplifted the local art community. And General Manager Misha Thomas says that's something she's talking to other management about bringing back. But it is important to note that the black and white photos that Taishia was talking about are from a local photographer named Jordan Christopher. They also changed the menu. So some people were a little bit worried, is my favorite menu item going to be on there? And I spoke to a man who said some of the things did have to get removed because they were and when they were evaluating this business model, they were saying, okay, we can't give everybody everything they want. Like, it was really nice for us to try to do this, but we're going to have to scale this back a little bit. So
I hear the mac and cheese was important, though.
The mac and cheese was really important to keep. And as Misha said, you might not get the same portion of mac and cheese that you once did, but it's still going to be one of the best mac and cheeses you've ever had. So some of the other things that they did keep were these muffins that they're really famous for. They're really tasty. I had one of them and it was delicious. And they kept their signature bowls, which are a mix of grains and veggies and meats, but they did something different and made them customizable, which was a really interesting new approach. And they have new additions like chicken and waffles with maple syrup and chimichurri sauce, something that the chef calls an emotion, and things like coconut wild rice. And everything on the menu kind of has a big influence from the African Latinx diaspora, which is something that reflects the diversity up in the neighborhood.
I see. So how does Haley House fit into that neighborhood then? Because gentrification is such an important topic in Boston. Nubian Square, the former Dudley Square, is not immune to that. How does the new Haley House fit into that trend?
Yeah, that's a great point, Callum. And that's something that was definitely a concern for Haley House because they wanted to stay relevant even in the midst of a changing neighborhood, but they also had to stay true to their mission. That's something that they really wanted to do even as they embraced a new identity. And so that meant continuing to uplift the neighborhood, continuing to hire people who have barriers to success, hire people who are from their neighborhood, and make it welcome. And that goes even down to the design of the new space. And it seems that regardless of the changes around Haley House, people are still going to come in and support it as a business. I met a couple named Phyllis and William Lewis. They had grew up in the South End and they live in Medford now, but they frequented Haley House for years and they were really glad that it reopened.
It still has the feel of a place that we can come to and still, you know, with the diversity, but still, you know, we can still commune with our people and still have diversity. I think it's a good thing.
I have to agree with that. As far as the desegregation of the gentrification of the area, that's happening everywhere, so you either got to get with it or, you know, move on. So I'm with it, I guess. So
he's with it, and whether or not everybody else is with it, that's yet to be seen. But
William and Phyllis are on board.
Yes, most definitely.
All right, that's Radio Boston's Paris Alston. Thank you for bringing us to the Haley House, but please bring me a muffin next time.
Sure thing.
Just like the home runs he used to hit at Fenway Park, Mookie Betts is out of here. Pending medical examinations, the Red Sox will trade the former AL Most Valuable Player and pitcher David Price to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Here to talk about it is WBUR's sports and society reporter, Shira Springer. Hey there, Shira.
Hello.
Also with us is Steve Buckley, columnist for The Athletic Boston. Hey there, Steve.
I'm not a sports and society. What is it?
Just
you
sports.
Are?
Just sports.
Just sports.
Yeah.
We're at the intersection, though, of sports and society.
And society, we'd like to hear from you as well. Give us a ring on the Red Sox. Are they making a terrible mistake here? What will you miss about Mookie Betts? And what about David Price? What's his legacy? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. All right, Shira, try to explain this. Why did the Red Sox trade their best player?
Okay, well, I think if you're going to explain it, you have to go off the field and to the Red Sox ledgers. This was basically a financial decision. So let's start off with the fact that the Red Sox didn't think they'd get a deal done with Mookie Betts in the offseason.
And he was going to be a free agent,
and
right?
And he was going to be a free agent, exactly. The two sides had tried to come to terms on a deal for a long time. Mookie Betts is looking at Mike Trout money, and for those of you who don't know who Mike Trout is, he plays for the Los Angeles Angels. I got to get that. It's hard to say after.
Are they of Anaheim anymore?
No, it's the Los Angeles. Yeah,
yes.
Anyway, considered the best player in baseball, and last March he signed a, get this, 12-year, and I think it was around $430 million deal. And Mookie Betts was going to be looking for that type of extension, was looking for that type of extension. He's widely considered to be the second best player in Major League Baseball. So there was that factor. They weren't confident they would come to terms on a deal. Then there was also the luxury tax threshold. The Red Sox desperately wanted to be below the $208 million luxury tax threshold.
That's the payroll for a season that
correct.
They would want to stay under.
Exactly. So you don't get taxed. Basically, they weren't going to get there with Mookie on the books for $27 million. So getting rid of him sort of solve some short-term problems and some potential long-term problems. Because, listen, if you lock up Mookie Betts for 12 years, you're locking up a guy until he's almost 40. And that's a long time. And so you could argue that it was a little bit of a pragmatic decision on the Red Sox part. And I will say, just kind of looking at some analysis of the deal, one of Steve's colleagues at The Athletic said that he had talked to two American League execs. And they said, for all of those fans out there who want to criticize the Red Sox, that the criticism was misplaced, that the Red Sox are getting two talented youngsters, which is greater value than draft picks. And also they have $40 to $50 million in payroll flexibility in the coming season. So
wait till next year? Here's the problem with that.
Yes.
The problem with that is trying to sign Mookie Betts now as opposed to signing him a year or two or three ago when mm-hmm. they recognized that he was a special player. A
Which, to Shira's point, is what the Angels did with Trout, right?
Yes.
They got him
And the Indians did it way back in the 90s with Carlos Baerga and Kenny Lofton and guys like that. They are Alomar, they had a collection of really good young players, and they signed them to extensions because they wanted to build a team around them. And whereas Mookie Betts is concerned, it's not just that he was a really good player, and he's a transcendent player, probably the best all-around player the Red Sox have had since Fred Lynn in terms of, outfielder who can run, he can hit, he can throw, hit for power, hit for average, everything, run the bases. And to take it to yet another level, and this is when we have an issue with when the player becomes a name, a figure on a ledger sheet, mm-hmm. you don't get a chance to stop and say, what does this guy mean to our brand? What does he mean to our community? And players love back rubs. They love to be told how special they are. They love money, too, as we all do. We live in a capitalist society. But at the same time, I think the Red Sox always took a very, this is what you are worth, this is the sabermetrics, this is the metrics and all that.
And that would appear to be especially the case with this new regime, with Hyman Bloom, the new general manager, up from Tampa.
And there are teams that said, this guy is special. And that's what the Angels did with Trout. There were certain teams, the Yankees did it for years with Derek Jeter. And the Red Sox never seemed to come to that agreement or see that with this guy.
So, fans, if you want to jump in on this one, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We haven't traded him away for nothing, Shira. And I do want to – I don't want to gloss over the Mookie Betts legacy, but I also want to think about what's coming.
You do?
Yeah, I do, because I want to know something about these guys. These are young prospects. So, Brustar Graterol from the Minnesota Twins.
I'm glad you pronounced that.
Trying that. And Alex Verdugo from the Dodgers. These are young guys, 21, 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What are we getting here? Can we get excited about these guys, or did we really get shortchanged?
It's really hard, I have to admit, to get excited. These are young guys, right? As you mentioned, 21 and 23. But it's hard to get excited because when, you know, a player of Mookie Betts' caliber leaves, you expect at least a recognizable name to come back in return. And I'll admit, when I heard these two names, I was like, wait, what? Huh? Who? So really, my familiarity with them is statistics. And so we have, just on Verdugo, he is entering his second year in the majors. He, as a rookie in 2019 with LA, he had a .294 batting average, 12 homers in 106 games. A little concerned there because the last couple months of the season, he was plagued by injuries, most notably a back injury. That's never something you like to hear about a young player. But
and Betts' durability was one of his key attractions.
It was
too,
one
right?
of his
certainly
key,
was.
Yeah, and also though, I mean, there were the people who are kind of saying, well, the Red Sox did what they had to do. People are wondering what Betts was, what, 5'9", and they were wondering about his long term durability. But I think he
sort
had,
of
he
like
had,
Willie Mays, right? used to worry about him.
What about Verdugo, Steve Buckley? What do we know about him?
Well, he's
I'm sorry, Graterol.
He's a young pitcher who's untested, whereas Verdugo is a major league ready player, and he goes right into presumably right field unless they want to move Bradley, although I don't know why they would. As far as prospects goes, I'm not a baseball beat writer, but I always tell – I'm a columnist, but I always tell people that if you are talking about prospects, the best way – the best analogy to make, especially if you're not a baseball fan, and this will resonate with a lot of your listeners, it's a stock. It's a stock certificate. You purchase stock in this player. Now, the financial guys might say, oh, well, this stock is going to be worth this much in 7 years. But we've all made investments, and the investment doesn't turn out very well. That's the nature of being a prospect, is that everybody's not. Now, there are certain cases. There are Ken Griffey, when he got drafted back in 1987 by the Seattle Mariners. There wasn't anybody who didn't think he was going to be a major star. But there's also guys like Patrick Lennon, who was a first-round draft pick, and the Red Sox have made a number of them where they just don't pan out. And then you have a lower-round draft pick. I think Keith Hernandez was like a 69th-round draft pick, or Jack Clark was another one. That's what I was thinking of, that are very low-round draft picks that turn out to be quality players. That's the penny stock that hit big. So you need to look at prospects through that lens. Whereas Mookie Betts, well, we already know what he is and what he will be, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to look at this in financial terms in some respects, because I think, you know, we were just talking about looking at the whole person, looking at the whole player. And I think one of the things that strikes me about this deal is they're not only losing a player, they're losing the face of the franchise and a person who is known for doing the right thing, doing things the right way, I think maybe a better way to put it. And one of the, you know, in addition to all the big hits and all the big catches, for me with Mookie Betts, one of the most memorable moments in his career as a Red Sox player will be what he did after Game 2 of the 2018 World Series, when he went out, I think it was on Boylston Street, and fed the homeless.
Yeah.
And he did that not expecting any recognition.
Jen McCaffrey from The Athletic just really, like, spent a day and a half tracking that down and wrote a really phenomenal piece. Much to Mookie's chagrin, which is a good thing to say about Mookie, is Mookie didn't want
exactly
the stage for that one.
But
it's something that evolved.
It's a perfect example of how the Red Sox had, and don't forget, this was a homegrown player too. So the Red Sox had in Mookie Betts a homegrown player who understood the city and cared about the city in a very personal way. And, you know, you just don't get the sense that that's what's coming in. And also you worry about if that's what's going to be developed now in their farm system. Players like that.
Yeah, there is that intangible value to consider. And I think that's something that Alyssa on the line in Groton is thinking about. Go ahead, Alyssa.
Yeah, I was just saying that when you have people like Mookie Betts and David Price who've been around the clubhouse, they impact the players' attitude, which translate into how they play on the field. And that's something you can't capture in sabermetrics.
Alyssa, good point. I mean, how about that, Steve? This is business after all, but
it is business.
We should think maybe more about
There is no doubt that there are players who are, you know, beacons of hope and optimism and leadership in the clubhouse, and there are those who aren't. And Mookie Betts, by all measures, was someone that players looked up to. I should also point out that David Price, for all the cloudy tenure he had during his Boston years, was, in point of fact, a player that was looked upon very highly by his teammates. So just because he didn't get along with wee little darlings of the media doesn't mean he wasn't a good guy in the clubhouse. So you need to see it through the lens of the players. Way back in the 1970s, the Red Sox allowed Louis Tiant to leave Boston, and he ended up with the Yankees. And anybody who was around back then, and I wasn't, I was covering high school soccer in Maine, but anybody who was around back then would tell you that Louis Tiant leaving the Red Sox, who had been such a dominant force in terms of leadership in that clubhouse, that it really hurt that team for a couple of years.
Well, Shira, let me ask you a little bit about the David Price legacy, because I think Steve makes an important point. I mean, Mookie Betts is clearly the centerpiece of this deal, but I don't want to totally forget about David Price. I think of him in some ways as kind of like a John Lackey. Remember,
that's an interesting comparison. Right? I mean, that's an interesting comparison.
The body of work was disappointing for the money they paid in free agency, but like Lackey, who helped the Sox to a World Series championship in 2013, Price stepped up big in 2018. We shouldn't forget that.
He did.
Right?
He did. I mean, listen, he was sort of the unexpected hero in some ways of that 2018 World Series victory. However, it is hard, I think, for those of us in the media to forget David Price's surliness when he was with the Red Sox. And yes, he did have a good relationship with his teammate, and his leadership in the clubhouse will be missed as a veteran pitcher. But to me, there is a bit of, and I hate to say it and I may get in trouble, but a little bit of good riddance David Price, because, you know, you mentioned 2018, but his career, you know, his time with the Red Sox was up and down and very unpredictable. And you kind of never knew what you were going to get, both in terms of play on the field and attitude.
And by the way, they still have to pay half his salary
exactly.
when he goes to L.A.
Exactly.
Last thing, Steve, just in the moment we have left, is this team mailed it in for 2020, or is there any chance that this is a contender?
Mailing it in is a very strong word that we don't like to use in the press box. No, I'm just kidding. is this team built to win in 2020? The answer is no. Has management mailed it in to the degree that they have taken two great players off their roster? Yes. I don't think the players will. We will see.
And whoever's coaching the team will wait and see.
It's a long season.
That's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer alongside Steve Buckley, columnist for The Athletic Boston. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.